He took the day off.
How are you?
Hello, I'm good. How are you?
Yeah. Every Saturday, it's
all the
creative
stuff. Some of that, that's the Saturday.
Yes, it really is.
I call the House Committee on Health Care to order for this March 20th of the year 2017. And we'll announce that we are not going to work House Bill 2114. I have an amendment coming that I think will make a lot of us happy. Some of the doctors and me both, so we'll be back probably maybe on Friday or maybe a week from today on that one. And we will not be doing a work session on House Bill 2114. I'm going to open a work session, I mean a public hearing on House Bill 3194 for the purpose of letting Co-Chair Hayden make a comment on that. And then I will close that public hearing.
Thank you, Chair Greenlake. This bill was a fairly simple 3194, pretty simple, straightforward bill that allowed alternative materials that are now available in the dental realm. Since the bill has been brought forward, the OHA has decided to look at the resin-based versus glass ionomer in a collaborative effort, and we feel that the bill is no longer necessary. So it was basically a materials-based bill in the statute that looks like it that will be repealed.
Thank you. I close the public hearing on House Bill 3194, and unless it appears before us in a different form, we will let it rest in peace. Open a public hearing on House Bill 3135. Representative Bueller, will you? Oh, well, first, will you tell us what we have here, and then we'll ask Representative Bueller to.
Can I ask
Mr.
Professor
Chair
Rodriguez also to?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 3135 is sponsored by Representative Bueller. It requires medical assistance program to reimburse costs of intrauterine device or a progestin implant in a postpartum recipient while the recipient is in the hospital for labor and delivery. And
you got it.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Chair Greenlake. Thank you, co-chairs. Thank you, esteemed healthcare committee members. I bring to you House Bill 3135, actually at the request of Professor Rodriguez, who identified the problem, and I'll do the best I can to define it. I'm out over my skis a little bit, being an orthopedic surgeon talking about OB, but I'm sure you'll correct me in your testimony. Here's the issue. At the time of a live birth, it's now becoming much more common to want to use intrauterine devices or long-acting reversible contraception during that live birth admission. There is some controversy in the field, but it's increasingly common practice. What is not common is our billing practices adjusting to medical practice, meaning that you have a DRG for 90 days, which won't cover both the device that's inserted for long-acting reversible contraception and the physician and hospital resources that go into that. So this would change the situation where at the time of live birth, you could have insertion of, for example, an IUD, and it would be compensated by the insurers. And that is the bill in its abbreviated and actually really short form.
Well, while you're there, why don't I open up the public hearing on House Bill 2527, and then you and the Senator can comment on that. Madam Minister, what have we got here?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2527 is also sponsored by Representative Bueller. This bill will allow pharmacists to prescribe and dispense self-administered hormonal contraceptive. It defines self-administered hormonal contraceptive, and it declares an emergency effective on passage.
Representative Bueller, you want to comment on that one?
Yes, thank you, Chair Greenlake. Our other bill, which is 2527, and working off the dash four amendments. Before getting into that bill, I want to just have a big thank you for all the people who've worked on the underlying concept. And some of you who were here last session on healthcare remember that we were the first state in the nation to essentially create functional over-the-counter access to oral hormonal birth control. And a lot of people did a lot of work on that project. Senator Steiner Hayward, Senator Bates was intimately involved, and a special thank you also to Representative Hoyle, who actually trusted me that this was a legitimate and good concept, even though it was on the cutting edge, that it would markedly improve access to contraception in a very important side effect would be to improve women's health and decrease poverty in the long term. That legislation has become a model for other states. It's moving through multiple state legislators. You'll be happy to hear during this year, and it actually started last year. We get multiple inquiries about the legislation we developed. In part of that process last time, we always intended to expand the methods of birth control that pharmacists could prescribe to what has been defined as self-administered, meaning patches, vaginal rings, or Depo-Provera type of injections. We thought that was too big of a reach, too far of a reach in the initial concept, so that we're coming back now once pharmacists feel comfortable with that process. Also, I should take a moment just also to thank the Board of Pharmacy, and specifically Mark Watt and OSU Pharmacy School, and Paige Clark, who have done an incredible job in implementing this program. California, you might remember, passed it, I think, in 2013, and have yet to implement this because of the difficulty. And our folks did a wonderful job, and it started right after the first year and almost flawlessly. So, Senator, would you like to comment?
We have a paradox sponsoring this bill, so it's a
paradox. Yeah, exactly. It's perfectly orthodox for two doctors to work together, so we're all good. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Elizabeth Steiner Hayward, State Senate District 17, and very proud to co-chief sponsor this bill with Representative Buehler. To be blunt, I think he's described it very clearly. I would almost describe this as a technical fix bill. It's not a huge expansion. The pharmacist with whom I've spoken, I happened to be picking up a prescription at a Fred Meyer Pharmacy the other day and saw a big sign that said, "We can now prescribe your birth control." And I was very excited by that, and I talked to the pharmacist, and she said, "Yeah, it's going really smoothly. It's really straightforward. We feel really comfortable with this. We get great training, and the women really appreciate the access to this." But we know that vaginal rings and Depo-Provera are injectable hormonal contraceptives, because in the long term there may be others of these that we use, are very analogous to contraceptive pills and contraceptive patches, and there's no reason not to include them in the list of things that pharmacists can prescribe directly. So we believe that because these are more appropriate methods for some women, that we need to offer the widest range of safe contraceptive options that are perfectly within the scope of pharmacists. In this state, pharmacists have been doing injections of vaccines and things like that for years. We passed legislation also in 2015 that allowed them to do certain travel things when they were collaborating with a physician or other licensed provider. So we really value our pharmacists as active partners on the front lines of healthcare to improve access. We know that for every dollar we spend up front on contraception, we save bare minimum $3 to $5 down the road because of avoiding unplanned pregnancies and the costs associated with those. So whether it's the bill that you were talking about when I came in to allow immediate insertion of IUDs after delivery of the placenta, or whether it's prescribing additional forms of contraception through pharmacies, those are all things that we know will decrease our unplanned pregnancy rate, improve women's education, increase their socioeconomic status, decrease health care costs, and all in all, be really great for Oregon. So we very much appreciate the committee's support.
Representative Alonzo Leon.
Yeah, thank you, Chair, and thank you both for this work. I think that this is a very promising bill, but it came to my attention that, and I don't know if you guys were aware, but some pharmacists are charging consult fees for women who request the prescriptions and the insurers are not covering it. So I wanted to know if you guys had any plans to address this problem in this particular bill.
Yeah.
Thanks. Mr. Chair, Representative Alonso Leon. Yes, good point. We've been working. One of the challenges is that historically pharmacists have not been considered independent licensed healthcare providers. Because the consultations required for immunizations and stuff that they were already doing were a little more limited than those necessary for prescribing birth control, this was a new problem, and we are working through it with DCBS and with the Board of Pharmacy and with the insurance companies, because we think it's appropriate that women get appropriate counseling and get a true consultation, which takes time, and it's not inappropriate for pharmacists to charge for this, but they should be reimbursed through the insurance company and not directly through the woman herself. So that's been one of the few glitches with implementation, but we're all well aware of it, and I think we're making good progress towards addressing it.
Follow up, Chair.
Yes, go ahead.
Yeah, I just wanted to bring it up because it was brought to my attention, particularly because it really impacts our low-income women.
I believe, Mr. Chair, Representative Alonso Leon, I believe that Medicaid already is paying the pharmacist for that, so it shouldn't be impacting. And in fact, it was just on International Women's Day a couple of weeks ago that we had our first over-the-counter prescription of birth control, or, you know, pharmacist prescription of birth control for one of our Medicaid populations. So I really feel happy about the progress we're making in that direction. And I think they worked out that issue from the get-go. So I feel confident that we're trending in the right direction, and this bill will provide more impetus to make sure that gets resolved quickly. Thank you.
It might be a CCO problem. We should probably check on that.
Chair Greenlee, it's actually been the slowest implementation for insurers paying for it is our own CCOs. The private insurers embraced it more rapidly, and so it is a CCO problem, but I've been assured that that will be resolved in the very near future.
Great. Are there any other question? Yes.
Just thank you, Chair Greenlee. Quick comment. I believe, if memory serves me right, that there was an amendment to another bill that fixed this in 2016 in the short session, and because it had some conflicts with some other entities, that was withheld. So I don't know if you recall that, but I think this amendment came forward in 2016, correct, in the short session?
Injectables and ring the, bill or the
yeah,
pain
the 20,
bill?
No, the 2527, no?
Yeah, it was, I think Representative Williamson, yeah.
Yeah,
but
Williamson.
She withdrew it.
Yeah.
Because we just, the pharmacist and the retail pharmacies didn't feel like they're just quite ready for it. So now they feel comfortable with the whole program.
Anyway, I wanted to thank those that brought it forward last time for being willing to take the time to smooth this out, and I think we're there now.
Great. Thank you, guys.
Okay. Thank you, Chair. So I just have to say, as a woman on this committee, thank you. It's about darn time. I said it before. I'll say it again. Job well done. So thank you. Appreciate it. Thank you very much.
Representative Melson, do you have a comment?
Yes. On behalf of I don't know how many women, this is a wonderful concept. I've spent my whole career counseling women that would call me either in a panic wanting to know about emergency contraception or having an unwanted pregnancy because of various reasons why they didn't get their prescription filled. And so I think this will eliminate a whole lot of those people in the future. So good job.
Yeah. I'll just comment on that. I get more comments at a variety of places, the stories of why this is important to women. It's just everyday concerns. They move and they don't have access to their OBGYN for 3 or 4 months, or they go on vacation,
or a family doctor, or they
go on vacation and leave their pills behind, or they lose them. It's just life things, but the implications of not having them are profound.
There's 101 reasons, but yeah.
Yeah.
Representative Rodriguez, Dr. Rodriguez, while they're sitting here, do you want to comment on?
Yeah, so Chairman Greenlee, thank you.
2135.
3135 comments?
3135.
Okay.
Chairman Greenlich, thank you very much for giving me the opportunity to speak today about House Bill 3135. My name is Dr. Maria Rodriguez, and I'm an assistant professor in the Department of Obstetrics and Gynecology at Oregon Health and Science University. I practice at the Center for Women's Health, and I'm a member of the American Congress of OBGYNs, a working group on long-acting and reversible contraceptive use. Both OHSU and ACOG, as well as multiple other professional societies, really recognize the importance of the policy of increasing access to postpartum contraception, specifically what's outlined here, increasing the availability of immediate postpartum intrauterine devices or implants. What we mean by that is that the exact same service that would be covered at an outpatient visit should be offered to women during their inpatient stay. And that's because unintended pregnancy is endemic across the United States, and that includes right here in Oregon, where nearly half of all pregnancies are still unintended. As Dr. Steinauer just alluded, that this is associated with multiple costs for the woman, for her family, and for our society, and that we have some very effective solutions to address it. However, there remains really important disparities in contraceptive use and unintended pregnancy as a result. And we know that young women and women of color are the most disproportionately affected by lack of access. Long-acting reversible contraception, such as the IUDs and implants, are up to 20 times more effective in preventing pregnancy than the short-acting methods that are readily available. However, a simple administrative barrier, as been alluded to, has prevented hospitals from widely offering the service to women who are interested in taking part in it. Our standard as obstetricians has been to offer postpartum contraception at a postpartum visit, typically 3 to 6 weeks postpartum after a woman gives birth. However, many women simply do not return for care, and this is especially true in the Medicaid population. We estimate about 60% of women enrolled in Medicaid return to see a physician or any kind of health care provider after giving birth. And from a study at OHSU, we know the risk is even higher than that. Of women who specifically said antenatally, like, yes, I'm coming back, I want an IUD or an implant, about 40% made it back for that visit. Yeah, so this is a really important opportunity that we have to improve health for women and newborns in our state. It's also important to recognize that women are at risk for pregnancy postpartum a lot sooner than they might think. If they're not fully breastfeeding, they can ovulate as soon as 3 weeks postpartum. And there's also data to support that close to 60% of women will have had unprotected intercourse before they see a healthcare provider in that postpartum period. So we have a very simple and kind of pragmatic option, which is to offer women effective reversible contraception of their choosing while they're an inpatient. We know it's safe. We have excellent data on that. We know it's effective. And we also have good information that women really appreciate this option.
Is this becoming under Cohen? Is that the last visit there?
Not yet.
No, it's not yet. It's not yet covered.
Yeah. No, I was saying would be with this. Well, since it's their inpatient, it's an inpatient charge.
I'll defer to the two representatives here, but my understanding is that emergency Medicaid has specific wording in it that prohibits the use of federal funds to cover sterilization, contraception, or death with dignity. So it would require an amendment to state law to do that.
So the COWM ends right at birth, so even if a woman wants her tubes tied, which normally happens within 5 minutes of a C-section, it is not.
Correct.
Reimbursable. It stops right at it's one of the really big problems because women can go back and get pregnant, and it would be wonderful if this bill could apply. It would add a fiscal, obviously.
If I may, Dr. Rodriguez, Mr. Chair, yes, it would add a fiscal, but at such, I mean, as I mentioned, I know Dr. Rodriguez is doing research on this as well. This cost savings would vastly outweigh the cost associated with the devices. I mean, there's really essentially, especially for the IUDs, there's no real cost to doing the insertion because you're already doing stuff. But I'm sorry to save
the technical
people in the room a little bit. But I mean, the implants take a little bit more work, but not a lot. You know, it's basically the cost of the device that you'd be covering, and it's a tiny fraction of the cost associated with prenatal care, labor delivery, and then the care for the newborn who is a U.S. citizen. So.
I think it's important to consider what the cost of the devices are, and that's what's been the big limitation to us providing them. The devices are actually so expensive that they're more than what you get reimbursed for a birth. So the hospital Legacy started to offer the service and was unable to continue it because they realized that they weren't being reimbursed and they were losing money. So that's what this policy kind of needs to address, is a pretty significant administrative hurdle that's prevented us from offering this choice to women and to their families.
We should urge the hospitals to cover it for the common population and then treat it as a community benefit expense, which we're negotiating with them right now. It would be a very legitimate community benefit expense. Maybe we should let Dr. Rodriguez finish. I'm the one that started the interruption. I'm sorry.
I think they've all been very important and useful points. And I guess I would just like to say in general that, you know, it's been a frustrating situation because this is definitely a valuable service that has important health outcomes for women. It also has the potential for very significant cost savings for our state. And it's been just a simple issue of not having the proper classification and administrative systems in place to allow us to do so. And this has really been a key missed opportunity for women and their families in Oregon, and I thank you for your work on this.
Yes, thank you, Chair. Dr. Rodriguez, you had said that the device itself was very expensive, which is why if they weren't getting reimbursed, they stopped doing it. But they were inserting it when they were getting reimbursed at a postpartum visit later, correct? How much is the device?
So the estimates I've seen for the cost of the devices range between $400 to $800. The copper IUD is the one that's been longest on the market. It's non-hormonal. That tends to be the cheapest. And there's about five progestin IUDs, one of which was specifically marketed to be sort of a low-cost alternative to the most commonly used one. Mm-hmm. Those are all more in the $600 range, though. And then the implant is about $800, I believe. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
But if I may, Mr. Chair, and Representative Kenny Geyer, I should point out that while that seems like a lot of money, it's a fraction. If you consider that they last for a bare minimum of 3 and often 5 to 7 years, that it's a tiny fraction of what the cost of other forms of contraception, especially when you consider the reliability. And I would ask the chair to indulge me for 2 seconds. Many of you will remember Susie Funkhauser, who was the lobbyist with OHSU before she went to OHSU as a medical student. She'll be graduating this year. She just matched into the OBGYN program at OHSU and is working with Dr. Rodriguez, so doing this very important research. So it's nice to see somebody who was in this policy side move into the medical side and still be working on the policy side, and I thank Dr. Rodriguez for working with her on this.
My pleasure.
Representative Melson.
Thank you, Chair. This question is directed to you, Dr. Rodriguez. I'm very excited about this possibility, but I have one question just so that I kind of understand this. Is there more reports of uterine cramping on women that are given this immediately postpartum? They're already cramping because of birth, and some people cramp more with an IUD. Is this going to be a problem with expulsion or more specifically with patient dissatisfaction?
No, we're doing follow-up research. OHSU has had a program under the benefit of donated devices for 8 years, and we're getting really high rates of satisfaction. And with the cramping, frequently women will have an epidural, and so you're administering it with great anesthesia and an exam that's much technically easier to do. Cramping is not noted to be higher. There is an increased risk of expulsion. However, when they're placed under ultrasound guidance, the risk of expulsion, while it's higher than in the interval period, it's still overall low. And again, as was alluded to, all these devices are incredibly cost effective. We did a research study showing that you'd have to be having IUD expulsion. 30% of them would have to be being expelled before this was not a cost-saving measure for the state, not just cost-effective, but cost savings.
Follow up?
Yeah.
And just in general, when you're counseling people, would they experience more cramping with breastfeeding with an IUD placed at this time?
And that hasn't been described in the literature,
okay.
No.
And
I haven't noticed it anecdotally.
Back.
Thank you, Chair. So the cost of the IUD being $600 or $800, I would assume will be less, though, because you won't have to call them back in for a separate procedure, and the cost for the separate procedure is, I would assume, to be more than doing it at the time of birth versus having them come back. Is that true? So you have a cost savings in that as well, correct?
Well, I don't claim to be an expert in medical billing or coding, although I've learned a lot during the process of trying to figure out how we can increase access to postpartum contraception in our state. I would again say that these devices are all covered when they're offered in the postpartum. So even though they're expensive, they're routinely covered by Medicaid and private insurers now. It's not the insertion that's actually expensive that's pretty small, but it's the device themselves. And so having it reimbursed in the immediate period, I think our greatest savings comes from preventing unintended pregnancy by not having women be lost to care.
Sure.
Great. If I may, Chair, certainly the convenience for the patient of not coming back for a second procedure and all the time involved in there is a big savings.
Okay. I think we have some more folks who want to talk about it. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Very much. Thank you for this bill... Justin Black, is that right? Anybody else?
For 3135?
No.
Yeah, it's just Justin.
Good morning, sir.
Morning. Chair Greenlake, members of the committee, Justin Black from the Oregon Health Authority. I think we wanted to come up and echo that this is the right way to go. You have on OLIS a notice that we sent out on January 1st saying that in the fee-for-service realm, this can now happen. I do understand that this was quite the process for us to get there, but starting January 1, hospitals can do a LARC immediately upon birth. It will be reimbursed. There were some issues on how the payment is bundled for a birth and us being able to include the LARC in that payment. So just wanted to let you know that on the fee-for-service side, this is already happening. I don't know about individual CCOs and whether or not it is available in all CCOs, but I do know on the fee-for-service population, this is now possible.
We would assume in the CCO population it is available and the ambulatory visit following.
Right? Chair Greenlake, members of the committee, I would assume so, but I don't have that definite, so.
Maybe you could check that out.
Sure.
Thank you, Jeff. Are there any questions, Mr. Black? Okay, we have three witnesses on...
just two, Mr. Chair.
Two witnesses on 2527. Is that right? Yes. Would you please call them?
Sure. Paige Clark, OSU College of Pharmacy, and Bill Cross.
Hello, Chair Greenlake and committee. I'm Paige Clark. I'm a pharmacist with Oregon State University College of Pharmacy. I'm the alumni director and also direct continuing education, which is what brings me to you today to just speak briefly about the implementation process that we've been through here in Oregon. You have my testimony in front of you in written form, so I won't take your time for that. I'd be happy to answer questions, but it is very nice to be able to thank Representative Buehler, thank many of the legislators here in Oregon who have really been remarkably groundbreaking in really assisting everyone in the implementation of this and in creating, of course, the language that created this. We are the first state to implement effectively, meaning that we are fully implemented, and the piece that had been spoken about briefly with regard to payment for pharmacists has been about credentialing and enrollment with the Oregon Health Authority of the individual professional. And happily, we have had an incredibly good experience with everyone at the Oregon Health Authority Credentialing and Enrollment Department. I need to give them tremendous kudos. And also on here, you can see some of the corporate partners who have been very, very generous with their time from a corporate standpoint, everything that it took to build all of that model here in Oregon, which is now being adopted by other states. The next state that is highly functional in this area is Colorado. And today, Colorado just loaded in their first pharmacists to go through the training and begin their process there. And they are looking to us to help them with full implementation as well, which is great. So many thanks to the many people who have really done this for the state of Oregon and done it very, very well, which is great. So if you have questions, I'd be happy to answer them if I'm able to do so. And I know that Bill Cross has a statement for you as well.
Representative Mueller.
Yeah, thank you, Chair Greenlee. Just for the record, I would like to thank Paige, who's done just a tremendous job in developing the educational component of this for pharmacists. This is the work is really becoming national. Whole states are just taking her work and just taking the modules and just taking it in total and using it for their pharmacists in other states. And it's recognized as just top-notch educational programming.
It's very nice. Thank you. There were many, many professionals in this state involved, as you can see in the documentation that I brought you here. So I appreciate that.
Will the education process be for these, which are somewhat more complicated? I assume we'll be able to modify the education without much problem.
In fact, Representative Chair Greenlick and committee, we anticipated, because other language that has not, while it's not been fully implemented in other states, their language originally included a more robust sort of use of these products. So they already had included the patch. For example, in California, they've already included Depo, and they've already included the ring. And so when we developed the training through the guidance of the legislatively mandated committee, and those who have all weighed in on this, we were given fairly clear direction to ensure that we had adequately included training and education in the certification initially, certainly that encompasses the ring. And then we very quickly, by some pharmacists in California and Washington and Idaho as well, asked us to increase and add on an additional module on Depo that has already been filmed and created and is already in use in three states, including in Colorado as well. So the certification really includes all of that. We will be pushing out to all of the Oregon pharmacists who are currently certified to do this for oral birth control therapies that module upon passage. We are prepared to do so. We also created this in a manner that it is available online, and it is the pharmacists can re-enter the program as many times as they would like in a two-year period. We also push out updates to them if there are any therapeutic important components that have changed, the mech changed, etc. So we have immediate ability to update that with all of the pharmacists in the state of Oregon as well. So that has been well received, which is very nice.
Mr. Cross?
Chair Greenlick, committee members, my name is Bill Cross. I'm here today on behalf of the Oregon State Pharmacy Association and the Oregon Health System Pharmacists, Oregon Society of Health System Pharmacists. We are in support of this bill, which would improve women's options, and believe it's just a natural extension of the legislation you approved in 2015, House Bill 2879. I think Representative Bueller has indicated the appreciation that we have towards Paige Clark and others who were involved in developing the certification and education components that helped implement this legislation. The pharmacists and pharmacy chains have been very involved, and now many of them are going through the certification. This bill makes sense in that it would add vaginal contraceptives, vaginal rings, and injectables. Pharmacists already have the ability to prescribe injectables, and this would simply add that to the list.
I think you better give up while you're ahead. You got five votes. You want to go for four?
I got it. I got to go.
Okay. I didn't mean it that way.
Okay.
Thank you, Chair. So, Mr. Cross, could you explain to us again what other is for women?
I doubt it.
And I'm not sure what the first word you had said. Well, I can't quite understand that.
Blushing.
Chair Greenlick, Representative Hack, I think, for the record, I said vaginal rings. Isn't that?
That's exactly what you said.
Thank you so much for confirming that.
My job is done.
But the redness is missing this time.
Oh, no. It's back.
Are there any other questions in this panel? Thank you very much.
Thank you. I'm sure.
We're going to close the public hearing on House Bill 3135 and on House Bill 2527 and open a public hearing on House Bill 3181. Madam Minister, what have we got here?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 3181 is sponsored by Representative Kenny Geyer. It provides that a statement from a parent or guardian releasing a student 7 years of age or younger from the requirement to submit certification that the student had received a dental screening within the previous 12 months may include an explanation of that reason that the student has, an explanation of why the student hadn't received the screening. This declares an emergency effective on passage.
Would you call a witness, please?
Okay. Mike Shercliffe, Melissa Freeman, Dr.
Wesson Herringer.
Yes, thank you. Wesson Herringer. Please. Want to testify?
Are there other witnesses?
There's one after that. There's Ken Yates.
Go for it.
I'm up first.
Mr. Chair, Ken Yates with the ODA. I could give a brief background of the current statute if that would be helpful to me.
Good, that'd be great.
I'll just do that very quickly.
Ken Yates, Director of Government Affairs for the Oregon Dental Association. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, thank you. I'll just give you a brief background on the law as it stands now and as it was enacted in 2015. Under the bill, schools must collect dental screening information for children under age 7 entering school for the first time. They must provide.
Yeah, chair coming here.
One here. Thank you.
Appreciate that, Mr. Chairman. Thank you. So schools must collect dental screening information for children under 7 entering school for the first time, must provide preventative dental care information as well. Schools may perform the dental screening themselves but are not required to, but must provide the preventative dental care information to new students. If schools opt to do screenings themselves, a licensed dentist, a licensed dental hygienist, or healthcare practitioner acting in accordance with State Board of Education rules, or a person who is employed of an education provider and is trained in accordance with the rules of the ODE and the OHA can also do this, such as a school nurse. School districts shall report the percentage of students who fail to provide a screening certificate to the ODE every year. These certificates, again, can be from dentists or from school personnel. Parents may opt out of dental screening requirements. There are no sanctions for students for failing to submit a certificate. Education providers shall file in the student's dental health record any certifications and results from the dental screenings known by the school. They also must provide the parent or guardian of each student with information, one, about the dental screening, two, further examinations or necessary treatments, and preventative care, including fluoride varnish, sealants, and daily care. The bill is introduced, has been described to you. Be happy to answer any questions about the law as it now stands. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman Greenlick, my name is Dr. Weston Herringer, and they wanted me to tell you a little bit about who I am since I'm a retired pediatric dentist, past president of the ODA. I've been a dentist for 39 years. The last 2 years of my career, I worked for the Dental Foundation of Oregon on the tooth taxi, went all over the state of Oregon, provided free care to kids. Before that, for 4 years, Jack Clinton hired me to restart the pediatric residency up at OHSU. And before that, I spent 23 years in practice, but I was also an active and reserve U.S. Army, retired as a colonel. I've treated children in Mexico, Panama, Honduras, Cambodia, and Romania. I made 19 overseas trips. And in Oregon, you can find dental disease in children as severe as anywhere I have practiced. Tooth decay is a preventable disease. 52% of the children between 6 and 9 years of age have had a cavity. That's approximately 66,000 children in Oregon. 19% of the children 6 to 9 years of age need early or urgent dental care. When I was on the tooth taxi, we'd look at the kids, we'd screen them, and the ones we'd be at a school for a week at a time so we could actually take the kids that needed emergent care that had pain and get them out of pain and provide care right at the school so they didn't, you know, miss more school time or their parents didn't miss work time. So that was pretty effective. But and as many as 3,800 children in grades 1 through 3 suffer from dental pain or infection in any given day. I once had a 13-year-old that had a tooth that he actually tried to extract a permanent molar by himself because it hurt so much, and it had gone on for several years. That was not listed here, but that's the kind of stuff that you see. The idea behind getting kids screened was to find out if they do have tooth decay so it can probably be addressed, but also the part of this legislation has to do with getting track of the data so that we can do something about keeping track of where the problems are and who has the problems. So the objective, I'm going to read this to you. The Oregon Dental Association is seeking amendment to House Bill 3181 to include comprehensive collection, aggregation, and reporting of data to lawmakers and the Oregon Health Authority regarding the types and prevalence of oral disease found in children under age 7 entering school for the first time. Individual screening findings shall continue to be completely confidential. The comprehensive data will be invaluable to lawmakers and OHA in making policy and funding decisions for improving children's oral health. So does anybody have any questions of me? I'd be glad to answer from my experience in dentistry.
We'll see. Let's finish the panel. Yes.
Hi, Chair Greenlick and members of the committee. My name is Melissa Freeman. I'm the Director of Strategic Projects at the Oregon Community Foundation. I also chair the Oral Health Funders Collaborative and have been investing my time in children's dental health for about 9 years. I just want to be here today to express my support for this dental screening bill and to ensure that the state and you all have access to the data and the results of the screenings. Currently, many of the funders that I partner with and through the Oregon Community Foundation, we are investing about $3.5 million into comprehensive children's dental health programs that are provided at the schools where they are. We do this in partnership with Advantage Dental and other dental care organizations. It's a complicated effort to coordinate all of that with the schools, and we need your help, frankly, in knowing where to go, where the schools are that have the populations with the highest risk, and make sure that the resources are used well and wisely. So thank you for taking this on. I worked on this in 2015, and unfortunately, due to the administrative rules process, the data was not getting back to all of us. So please, in this effort, I just urge you to make sure that that data is reported and used so that we can use our resources in the most cost-effective manner. Thanks.
Chair Greenlick and members of the committee, thanks for the opportunity to be before you again 2 weeks in a row. I appreciate it. For the record, I'm Dr. Mike Shercliff, a dentist and the CEO of Advanced Dental, based in Redmond. We're in all, we're 35 out of 36 counties and all 16 CCOs, and I come in support of this bill, especially -2 amendments that we're offering. We had a bill similar that we wanted to put forth, but with this bill, we want to add a -2 amendment, and I want to speak to that. But before I do that, I want to support what the folks here at the table are talking about, because it's really interesting when you go to be able to the whole transformation projects we got going on. It's fascinating to be able to stumble over some of the rules we have from the old way of doing it, which is being able to collect the data in a way that's meaningful so we can manage the population based upon the risk of that population versus just doing everything the same, because we're frankly, we can't afford to do that. It doesn't make sense, and it actually gives treatment to people that really don't need it. And in the new way of doing things, we really, really can't be doing that. And so I'm here to support this. I'd like to offer the -2 amendment, which is expanded to age 14. It's interesting to me because of one of the requirements we have in the CCOs is to get sealants on molar teeth of children 6 to 14, and we're stopping this at age 7, and we'd like to offer the -2 amendment, which expands at age 14. The second thing we'd like to do the older kids are often missed. The -2 amendment is intended to provide an opt-out mechanism for passive consent. Parents would be notified 2 weeks before the screening and could choose to exclude the children. What we have now is they send the notifications home and they never get them back, and so they can't get screened. And this is not about treatment. This is about screening and collecting data so we then can use risk assessments to offer appropriate treatment. A lot of times you'll go into the school and you'll not be able to see kids, and when you get them into your office, they've already been sealed because the data hasn't been transported anywhere. And so this kind of legislation that we have before you will help us with that, help us not stumble over ourselves and be able to collect data and be able to be more efficient and effective with the limited resources we have. Thanks for the opportunity.
Could somebody recap what the bill does, 1-2-3 fashion, and then there are two issues in the -2s, right?
Chair Greenlick, the bill actually allows the data to be collected because the data is not being collected. The screen data is not being collected. The -2 is actually -1, but it said in there we're going to mail stuff in snail mail. Well, nobody mails stuff in snail mail, so it's changed to make it sure that the data is collected by mail. Either kind of mail you want to do it by, either by email or by snail mail. So the -2 is really -1, but with small one-word change. And what it does then is it expands it from age 7 to 14, and it allows passive
opt-out.
The opt-out, yes.
Okay, are there any questions to this panel?
Kenny Guy.
Well, thank you. Quick comment, and I, as always, have enjoyed co-chiefing this with the good vice chair here. So my understanding of, mainly the thing in the base bill here is that we did say that if parents did not want to go through the dental screening, it was either because they had a religious exemption or it was a burden, or they had already done it. But apparently that wasn't clear enough, because what happened in the rulemaking, it didn't get spelled out clearly enough. And so basically people are checking boxes. So what this bill does is ask them to give a statement about why, if it's contrary to their religious beliefs or if it's a burden to the student, why? Because part of the whole point of this was to get more data about why kids were not getting dental screening. And so that's the main thing in this bill here. I'm happy to work on amendments as well, but that was the main piece of this bill.
Do you approve of the -2s?
I haven't seen them yet, so eager to work.
The -2?
Yes.
We just got them, and they should be up on all us if you want to refresh, maybe, and they should be there. And our printer in the hearing room isn't working, so I can't even print hard copies for you.
It's all right. It's there. Okay. We only have a public hearing day anyway.
Correct.
Great. Okay. Well, thank you very much for bringing this.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and we look forward to working with Representative Kenny Geyer and Representative Hayden on amendments. Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. Pediatric dental team. We're going to close the public hearing on House Bill 3181. Anything else to be brought before the committee?
Not today, Mr. Chair.
My goodness. What am I going to do with all my time?
We are adjourned.
Are
you go take a nap.
Oh. Oh. Time.
We are adjourned.
Are
you go take a nap.